And I'm collaborating in this work with these people here who are all in London. And if you're interested in reading more about the talk, it's contained in these two papers that are on the archive. So to motivate the question, there's a sort of vacuum crisis in high-energy physics, I would argue. Basically because we're enamored with this idea of symmetry breaking. So theories of particle physics with a unique vacuum are just simply hard to come by when you accept this paradigm. And it happens everywhere. So it happens in the Standard Model, happens in grand unified theories, happens in theories with supersymmetry. And it sort of gets amplified when you consider theories with extra dimensions like string theory, because you're forced to do something with them. Typically, you compactify the extra dimensions. And if you think that extra dimensions have anything to do with our four-dimensional world, then depending on the size, topology, shape of the compact extra dimensions, you get many four-dimensional vacua. So this sort of begs the question for cosmology, given this proliferation of many different vacua, well, we don't seem to see any time evolution of fundamental constants, say. We see a very static world. So we're in a vacuum, and you want to know how we got there. And possibly ask the question if there's any cosmological signatures of how we got there, whereby we could determine perhaps the principle by which different vacua are entered, et cetera, et cetera. So one proposal is to do everything. And this goes under the name of eternal inflation. So if I have some simple one-dimensional scalar field potential, and I happen to find myself stuck up here in some metastable false vacuum, then quantum mechanically, I can tunnel through the barrier and end up on the other side. And in real space, what that looks like is the nucleation of a bubble, which contains a lower energy phase, and it's energetically favorable for that bubble to then expand and sort of eat into that high energy false vacuum. And you can go one step further, take this potential and make it somewhat realistic by embedding our cosmology inside of the bubble. So here's a space-time diagram. This is an expanding bubble wall. And if I engineer my potential correctly, then I can have slow roll, reheating, standard Big Bang cosmology, and all of this is embedded inside the bubble. So from the symmetries of the instanton that generates the bubble, I know that I generate a more or less homogeneous, open Robertson-Walker universe inside here, where the surfaces of constant time and constant energy density simply just foliate the interior of this light cone that's in the center of the bubble. So by nucleating this bubble, I get this infinite open Robertson-Walker universe basically for free, and I need this secondary epoch of slow roll inflation because we know that we don't live in a very open universe, and we need to produce the density perturbations that seed galaxy formation, etc. So this idea has been around for a very long time. It goes by the name of open inflation, and it was more or less introduced to explain why we lived in an open universe when we thought we lived in an open universe from the COBE data. So that's one bubble. But when I have positive vacuum energy in the false vacuum, I get inflation. So bubbles are forming from this high energy phase, but they're expanding away from each other. And if the rate of formation is sort of outpaced by the rate of expansion from this background false vacuum, then inflation becomes eternal to the future. So this is a constant time slice in some co-moving coordinates. And bubbles that form early in this coordinate set show up as these very large circles. Bubbles that form later show up as very small circles. And you end up with this fractal distribution of bubble sizes. And this corresponds to different vacua being seeded from this original false vacuum. And from this picture, you get many cosmologies evolving to many vacua. And the standard lore is that we're somewhere in that mess. Okay, so this is the standard lore of eternal inflation. I would argue it seems to be a fairly general consequence of swallowing the idea of extra dimensions and accepting the fact that we have positive vacuum energy early in the universe because we think it inflated, and late in the universe now because we see evidence for dark energy. So there's strong theoretical motivation, but a question you certainly would want to ask of this framework is it any way experimentally verifiable? So you hear things about sort of anthropic arguments in the landscape. That's perhaps one avenue you could take, but I would advocate taking a different avenue. So if you zoom in on this picture and concentrate on this big bubble here, then you'll note that in this fractal, there's going to be an infinite number of collisions with other bubbles. It really is a fractal, so if I zoom in on any portion of this wall, I see more and more bubbles. So there's this infinite number of bubble collisions that's predicted by this framework. And we can ask, who gets to observe these collisions and what would they see? Perhaps this could be our golden ticket to finding some sort of cosmological evidence for eternal inflation or the fact that we might have entered a vacuum through bubble nucleation. So there's two base conditions that are necessary to see a collision. Okay, so the first one is very simple, causality. So if you're going to see a collision, you need to be in its future. Okay? The second is that we shouldn't have to put ourselves in some unbelievably fine-tuned special place in that picture to be able to see something if we're actually going to be bothered to go and, say, look in the data, which we will do later, and see if they're there. And further, we're sort of most interested in cases where the collision is detectable in the sense that it's not a blinding signature on the sky that's already there, but it's sort of buried. So it's a minor perturbation on our observed cosmology. Oh. And so to determine the observability of bubble collisions, to sort of satisfy these criteria, we want to ask a few base questions. Okay, so first of all, how lucky do we really have to be? So how fine-tuned is it to be the case that a randomly chosen observer, say, sees bubble collisions in their past? We want to know what the space-time structure in the aftermath of a collision is because, well, we want to know if it's survivable. Can we exist to its future? And can it, in this sense, be detectable, leading to just a minor perturbation on our observed cosmology? And lastly, we want to ask what the detailed observational effects of the collision could be. So let me just briefly go through the attempts to answer these three questions. This could be a talk in and of itself. There's been a lot of papers on this. But I'll just give you a sort of status update and give you a flavor. Yeah?
Is it actually evident that there will be an infinite number of collisions? Because if you say that inflation outpaces bubble inflation, mm-hmm. you would actually think that there are most probably no collisions at all.
Yeah, so you don't get percolation. But if I zoom in on any given bubble, then it's growing forever, basically, because inflation is eternal. So if there's no percolation, each bubble gets to grow forever. And if a bubble nucleates within sort of a causal length, so a horizon length away from this bubble you zoomed in on and chosen to concentrate on, then it's going to collide with you, guaranteed. Basically, because the walls are expanding at the speed of light, you're guaranteed a collision. So if I've got forever to wait and an infinite surface area on this infinitely large bubble, then if I add them all up, I'm going to get an infinite number of collisions. That doesn't mean that any given observer is going to see them all.
That's right. Is there no percolation for any kind of inflation?
No. There's a condition. So basically you need, the catchphrase is less than one bubble per Hubble. So if I have a nucleation rate that's less than one bubble per Hubble volume per Hubble time, then I get eternal inflation pretty generically. So let's ask this question, how lucky do we have to be? And this will sort of get back to Yosef's question about this infinite number of bubbles. So here's the assumptions that we're going to make. So we're going to assume that at some initial time, the universe was in a false vacuum. Now, this has basically introduced a preferred frame. So we need to have some portion of the universe where the initial condition was smooth, homogeneous enough to allow this to happen. This is sort of the same thing that we invoke when we talk about regular inflation. We needed the universe to be in some inflating phase, smooth enough to get things going. So here's some initial time slice. Here's a sort of time diagram and co-moving distance on the side. And this is a top-down picture looking at a co-moving slice in the spatial sense. And we're here. We're in one of these late time bubbles. So I told you that you get a fractal distribution. And the statistical properties of the size, type, et cetera, approaches a constant as I go to late times. So there's a sort of attractor behavior. And we're going to assume that we're in this attractor regime. Assume that the collisions don't perturb the bubble interior, which is a dumb assumption, but we need to break progress somehow. And assume further that this original open Robertson-Walker foliation is is good enough. So there's some scale factor as a function of time, and then there's some distance variable, radial distance, xi. Further, we're going to assume that bubbles can be approximated as light cones. So if a bubble forms somewhere, it eats up everything in its future light cone. So under this set of assumptions, if I take this single bubble spacetime, here's the bubble we're supposedly in. It has these constant time surfaces where you get inflation, reheating, etc. And here we are sitting here at the present. Now, if I trace our past light cone, it exits the bubble, and there's some exterior volume in this false vacuum that's in our causal past and to the future of this initial condition surface. So there's some four volume associated with this piece of the outside space that we can see. And if I want to know how many bubbles nucleated in my past, I take the probability that a bubble forms per unit four volume, and I multiply it by the four volume in my past. Now, I told you that you introduced a preferred frame. Yeah, yeah. So the four volume is finite because I've chosen a special initial condition surface effectively. So if I choose an initial condition surface that, even if it's at infinite flat Robertson-Walker slicing time in the past, you still get a finite number of collisions. You can just sit down and calculate it. Okay, it's finite. Yeah. If I had chosen another initial condition slice, which, say, included part of past infinity here, where I have an infinite amount of volume, then I would see an infinite number. But choose a reasonable surface, and you get a finite number.
So what singles out that surface?
Yeah, that's a choice. It's initial conditions.
So. More personal.
Initial conditions, yeah. Take, at any point in the past, a Hubble size volume and make it in the false vacuum. And that's your determination of the initial condition surface, say. Okay, so bubbles that nucleate here are in principle observable. And I told you we've, by introducing this initial condition surface, sort of defined a background frame. So I can be moving with respect to this frame. So let's say I'm out here, and I'm observing bubbles in my past. Here's one. It collides with me, affects the future here. Then we can do a translation which corresponds to a boost in this picture, put ourselves at the origin. But since I have a preferred frame, that's going to screw things up in the outside. So I boost this initial condition surface to somewhere else, and I boost this bubble to somewhere else. I move it around. So if we put ourselves in the center, then it was noted by Garriga, Guth, and Valenkin, famously, that there is this persistence of memory of this initial condition surface that doesn't increase, that doesn't disappear with the number of e-folds of this eternal inflation in the outside. So if I'm here, since I've boosted this initial condition surface by putting myself at the origin, then I have more four volume on the outside to my right than to my left. So I see an anisotropic distribution in the arrival of these bubble collisions. And if I count the total number that I see, it goes like this. So lambda is the nucleation probability per unit four volume. This is the false vacuum Hubble constant. And this is the ratio of the false vacuum Hubble constant to the inflationary Hubble constant times the position that I was originally at on one of these constant time surfaces. And since all positions are roughly the same, then this predicts that if I'm a randomly chosen observer, basically I should see an arbitrary number of collisions in my past. So I'm effectively guaranteed to have a collision in my past according to this simple calculation. But if I look at what most of them do, they're sort of not interesting at all. So here is, say, the surface of last scattering. Here I am, I'm looking back into the past, and here's a bubble that's collided with me. So it turns out that most of the collisions that were encompassed in that number are of this type, where they affect a portion of the surface of last scattering that's far larger than what I can actually see. So these are like super, super, super Hubble modes. This is a complete like IR effect. And so you're not really going to see anything here. Now, if I repeat this calculation and I ask how many collisions are actually going to have observable effects, meaning that the future light cone intersects this part of the surface of last scattering that I can see, you get this number. which you'll note does not depend on my original position inside the bubble. In fact, that infinity has been completely regulated by just asking for the things that I can actually observe.
Matt, can you go back to that picture? You say it's unobservable, but the collision is in our parts like.
Yep.
How do you know the collision didn't make a black hole or something like that?
So for that particular example, you know that they can't make black holes because of the sort of hyperbolic Birkhoff's theorem in energy conditions. So you can show that there's no way to make black holes in a collision between two bubbles. If you have more than two, then that might be possible, but with just two, that's not possible. I'm going to show you in a slide.
But if I have an infinite number, I'm sure I can get three bubble collisions
and four bubble
collisions.
That's right. So, good question. maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. So this infinity might get regulated in a different way. That's entirely possible. Okay. So, but if I ask for the collisions that are actually observable, then you get an answer that looks like this, where omega c is the present day energy density and curvature. Okay. So again, we've got the probability per unit 4 volume. This is generally exponentially suppressed, so this is a very small number. And we've got this ratio of energy scales, which could possibly be a large number if I have a false vacuum, which is much higher energy than the inflationary phase. And then I've got square root omega curvature, which is, again, possibly quite a small number. Maybe it's not that small, but it's definitely less than 1. So the summary, bottom line, is that if collisions are survivable, we almost certainly have one to our past. But if we want to expect more than one visible collision in our past, we basically have to require that there's at least one transition from the false vacuum that satisfies an equality like this, considering that omega curvature is not too small. Okay. So that's what we understand about that. Now let's move on to talking about what we understand about the bubble collision spacetime itself. So from symmetry, the bubble collision spacetime has this SO21 symmetry. Basically, I had SO31 symmetry of the original bubbles. That just means spherically symmetric and constant acceleration. And therefore, it's a hyperboloid. So if I intersect two hyperboloids, I get in a hyperboloid of one less dimension. Okay, so that's where this SO21 comes from. And as I mentioned, there's this hyperbolic Birkhoff's theorem, which says that there's no gravitational wave solutions, just like for a spherical source. And the only thing I have is sort of Schwarzschild and Sitter-like metrics. So one thing I can do just to start to get an idea is some sort of thin wall matching. So if I start off with two bubbles, they're parameterized by energy scale inside the two bubbles, and their walls have some tension, I can smack them together and ask what happens. So if the phase is different in these two vacua, then you have to form a domain wall between them. Okay? So that domain wall has some tension. And the domain wall is going to accelerate to the right if this condition is satisfied, which for small tensions is basically requiring that the energy density in the colliding bubble is less than the energy density in our bubble, say. And it's going to go to the left if the opposite is true. Okay, it's higher energy inside our bubble and less lower energy inside the other. In general, you have to conserve mass, so you have to shoot out some other debris. But you can roughly characterize all the possible spacetimes in this thin wall problem. Okay. So if we're going to see a collision, we have to be low energy relative to the bubble that collides with us, because we want that wall to zoom out of our bubble, not zoom into it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So that's one thing to understand about these collision spacetimes. Now, you can do a little bit more by performing numerical simulations. So I did these numerical simulations with Anthony Aguirre and Marty Tyscenter, where we start with a field that looks, a potential for a scalar field that looks like this. Here's some false vacuum, and I can go here into some other vacuum, and then I can go here onto some inflationary track. So if I nucleate a bubble to the left, I get this white guy. If I nucleate a bubble to the right, I get this darker bubble. And if you look at the surfaces of constant field, and sorry, this is a little bit hard to see, but effectively what happens during this collision is that the inflaton gets advanced in the future of the collision. But nevertheless, at late times, you end up with what's more or less the original homogeneous isotropic open Robertson-Walker foliation. Sorry, it's totally impossible to see. But trust me, you end up with something that looks like a smooth homogeneous universe to the future of the collision if you're far enough away. Okay? So that's good news because it means that we might live there. We see a relatively smooth, homogeneous, open, not necessarily open, but Robertson-Walker universe. And so this is possible, basically, that the collision is survivable. And by tuning things, you can make this discontinuity arbitrarily weak. So it's at least plausible that there are some models where collisions are detectable in the sense that there are minor perturbation on top of our observed cosmology.
So is this done in thin wall approximation, or?
No, this is field dynamics, and so it includes without gravity, yeah. But you'd expect, at least for the time slice that I've shown here, gravity isn't important. The energy densities are small. And right here, you have curvature domination, which basically looks like Milne foliation of flat space. So you can expect that flat space is a fairly good approximation, at least for a little time.
So there's no local space-time region within the simulation where you see, where coming into gravity would lead to problems?
I don't think so. Yeah, I don't think so. I think a fairly straightforward adaptation of this picture would really just be to consider some weak field approximation on top of the background desiderium. Absolutely. So there's a kinematical dependence here as well, which would determine the strength of the signatures. So that's in there too.
But there's no real cutoff in the theory for that?
Yeah, so you can only get arbitrarily far apart because you're in a de Sitter space, so you can't separate the bubbles farther than a Hubble length. So there is an upper bound on the strength of the signature for sure. That just comes from that.
I thought you could have the bubble quite far to the future of your initial episode, and you could have highly relativistic collision coming from a bubble to your parts.
So you can always boost into a frame where they're simultaneous. So it's a little bit tricky.
No, okay, sorry. That's okay.
The invariant distance is fixed, right?
That's just with two.
Yeah. If you have third, then that's different. Okay, so that's a very, sorry?
It sounds dangerous.
Well, the thing is that if you want all three collisions to, So I should say for everything that follows, we're more or less operating in a fairly fine-tuned regime where you expect to see only a few collisions, not many. In that case, interactions between three bubbles are rare, and I wouldn't worry about that. That's an interesting case that that one should explore for sure.
That is a tuning of the initial conditions.
That's a tuning of nucleation rates and initial conditions. Yeah.
So it's a little weird that inflation is now operating in a region of tuning of initial conditions.
Well, we were doing that anyways in normal inflation.
I agree. It's become more so over time.
So, assessing the details of the story have been the topic of many papers. Some of the authors are listed here, and there's lots of work to do, as Neil is asking about, what about three bubbles, what about four bubbles, et cetera. So there's more stuff to be done here. just some bullet point list of things to possibly be done. Well, you want to know the outcomes of collisions. You want to do model building to see in which cases we get observable collisions. You want to do simulations to check this. And then you want to find the exact imprint left on the CMB, which we haven't touched on yet, but we will in a second. So for this talk, we want to ask, what's a good guess for the signature? And how might we look for signatures of this type? And I'll argue that there is a fairly good guess. That should be pretty generic. So the first thing is that we know that there is a causal boundary for these collisions. So here's our bubble. Let's say here is reheating and we form from some structure that is co-moving with respect to this foliation inside the bubble. The collision happens and it sort of takes a portion of the universe and it perturbs it, changes a little bit. And where, so the future light cone here, or perhaps you could say it's co-moving, so some co-moving future of this point, is affected by the collision and any point outside that is not. Okay, so there's this causal boundary. Further, inflation has blown up this collision and basically shrunk our past light cone on the surface of last scattering. So we have access to much less than a curvature radius, just because we know we're not in a strongly open universe. And that means that what we can see of this collision, this is a constant time slice inside the bubble. If we zoom in on our past light cone, then what we can see of the collision basically has planar symmetry. Okay? And further, this collision is going to have azimuthal symmetry on the CMB sky. This just comes from the symmetry of the colliding bubble spacetime. It has intersect two soap bubbles. The intersection is a ring. Okay? So we're going to see the effects of the collision confined to some disk on the sky, given by whatever the intersection of our past light cone with this planar perturbation is. Now, since we're not looking for a blazing huge signal on the sky, we know it's not there, let's assume that it's more or less a modulation of the background fluctuations, okay? So assume that delta T over T as we measure it on the CMB sky is going to be some modulating function F times the standard Gaussian perturbations given by delta normalized. And that's the one. So since the collision is a pre-inflationary relic, it's stretched. So this is some planar perturbation that has been drastically stretched by the inflation that happens inside the bubble. So a fairly reasonable thing to do would just be to Taylor expand the temperature about the point where you have the causal boundary and keep the first few terms. So this is going to be our hypothesized template. It's basically characterized by a few numbers. So the first is the amplitude at the origin. So if I center this collision around the North Pole, it's got some amplitude at the origin. There's some discontinuity at the edge given by z crit, and it has a characteristic size given by theta crit. And you can confirm that this is a reasonable thing to do by doing simulations. And so this has been done, and you effectively get templates that look like this. Okay. So now, that's what a collision might look like. How would we actually go look for it on the CMB sky? And the second half of my talk is going to be completely dedicated to this data analysis part. Okay? So we want to ask the question, I've got in my hands the WMAP data, and how are we going to look in this and find evidence for a bubble collision? So in a perfect world where I could have a computer more powerful than all the computers tied together on Earth, what I would do is basically test the hypothesis that there might be a bubble collision on the CMB sky by doing some sort of Bayesian statistics. So ask the question of Bayesian model selection, which is how much better does one model describe the data than another? And the two models that I'm interested in comparing are lambda CDM cosmology and the power spectrum, say given from an inflationary model, to a model that has that, plus an arbitrary number of collisions described by this template that I showed you before. So how would I actually do that? So in Bayesian statistics, I can calculate the ratio of probabilities for a model given the data by looking at this. It's the product of a ratio of model priors times the product of a ratio of a quantity called the evidence. Okay? So this is the probability of a data given the model. And rho will be the sort of arbiter of a detection, how we decide if we have a significant thing or not. This is the evidence ratio. So how do we calculate that? So formally, it's given by this. There's a prior on the parameters in the model, theta, times what's known as the likelihood function. So this is the probability of the data given the model with a particular set of parameters. In the limit where you have a large set of data, you can assume that this is Gaussianly distributed and calculate the likelihood just as the data minus what is expected from the model. So this is each data point, say each pixel in the WMAP sky, combined with the covariance. So the covariance tells you how the different the temperature at different pixels is correlated. And for WMAP at full resolution, there's 3 million data points. So that covariance matrix is a 3 million by 3 million matrix, and you need to invert it. Okay, so there's no way that that's going to happen, right? So let alone do that for a 5 times number of bubble collisions dimensional parameter space. Okay, so this is just completely impossible. Further, you might want full resolution because the template that I showed you before, you want to be able to distinguish it from other templates, say. So the more data you have, the better. So you really don't want to degrade the map. So in a not-so-perfect world, what we're going to propose to do is to isolate the most promising candidate signatures somehow. Okay, but this is really dangerous because you don't really want to choose some spots on the sky just completely a posteriori. So I like that spot, and therefore I'm going to go look for it as evidence for a bubble collision. So, but you know, instead of just saying that, we do have a few targets that we can search for, a few targets that we can zoom in on different portions of the CMB sky that might be more interesting to us. So we know the signature we're looking for has azimuthal symmetry, it has this causal boundary, and whatever temperature perturbation that it induces on the CMB sky is sort of long wavelength modulation inside of a disk. And there's a set of tools that we can apply that are sensitive to the different parts of the signature, which can go into the full sky and sort of isolate things. So the first thing that you can do is what's known as wavelet analysis. So this is, I'll describe it in more detail in a second, but basically a good way to have a compromise between a completely Fourier space analysis and a completely real space analysis. So this is good for picking out localized features and telling you something about their size. We can look for that causal boundary by doing a form of edge detection. So this is basically image processing. And then in the end, when we've located the most interesting places on the sky, we can go back and perform the same kind of model selection I told you about before, but restrict ourselves to a portion of the sky where that covariance matrix is not 3 million by 3 million, but some more manageable size. And we can actually do it. So here's our pipeline. Basically, what we want to do is start from a map. This wavelet analysis is going to identify the most interesting places on the map that might be candidate bubble collision signatures. And then simultaneously, we're going to perform in those regions of the sky an edge detection and model selection algorithm. So this is fully automated, and that's very important, right? So I start with the map, and I don't know anything until I get the results in the end. So this is a blind analysis, and that's going to get around the problem of picking things a posteriori. Further, we're going to calibrate it with simulations, so we kind of know what we're expecting to get in the end by looking at what we get for simulated bubble collisions and simulations of the data from the experiment without bubble collisions. And we're going to freeze everything before we touch the data. So now let's describe the steps in more detail. So wavelets are basically a way to pick out localized features with different angular scales. So we know that real data is given on this pixelated sphere, where the pixels are labeled by some integer k, say. And we can define a form of wavelet transform known as a needlet transform, which, because of its definition, has the nice property that I can decompose a temperature map into a sum over coefficients times functions, and I can reconstruct the temperature map from the coefficients. So it's kind of like a Fourier transform, but not really, because this is an overcomplete basis. I have information both about location and frequency. So it's an overcomplete basis. Now, if I look at the shape of these functions, basically the needlet functions are labeled by two integers, the pixel k, so that's the location, and the frequency j. So this is a plot of what these functions look like as a function of the polar angle theta on the sphere. So if I move the function around at fixed frequency, its center moves, and you'll note that these functions are localized, so they're peaked in one spot, so the wavelets are good at picking out localized features. It's the claim I made before. And if I increase the frequency, basically I increase the sharpness of that peak. So if I go to high frequency, I'm going to be sensitive to small-scale structure. If I'm at low frequency, I'm going to be sensitive to large-scale structure. Now, these functions are also nice because if I had a Gaussian CMB without cutting the sky with a mask and I didn't have noise, I know exactly what the statistical properties of these coefficients are. So they're steps emitted, but you can show rigorously, mathematically, that the expected mean of these coefficients is zero, and the expected variance is just related in a straightforward way to the underlying power spectrum if I had a Gaussian underlying set of fluctuations that I'm decomposing. And this is some function which depends on the wave number and the frequency of the needlets, which is known, but I've just omitted here.
Do the needlets satisfy some complete misrelation?
They are what's known as a tight frame. Okay, so tight frame means you can have that reconstruction formula where I can go from the coefficients back to the original map. But nevertheless, I have an overcomplete basis. So. Yeah, and there are some properties that you have to satisfy. The shape of those functions isn't arbitrary. You had to satisfy a number of mathematical requirements in order to make that happen. Yeah.
Can you relate them to standard spherical
harmonics? Yeah, and that's why you can get the relation between the variance and the power spectrum. That's right. So on a Gaussian full CMB sky, this is what you expect. And on a cut sky with noise, there is a mildly biased variance in mean. But you have a well-defined limit in the limit of a full sky. So we can calculate what the expected bias is by doing Monte Carlo simulations of the CMB sky. So you can see here is the uncut sky, the variance of the needlet coefficients at a particular scale. And when I introduce the mask, you can see that there's this large bias that arises on the boundaries of the mask. So what we can do is, given this data of the expected variance, define an unbiased statistic where we basically just subtract off the biased mean and divide by the biased variance to give you some idea of let me show a picture. So if I had a bubble, here's the bubble in the temperature map, and I decompose it in terms of these needlet coefficients. So if I fix the frequency j, at each pixel k of the map, there is a needlet coefficient. And so I'm going to get a hit here, which is centered on the location of the bubble. Here's just a zoomed-in picture. Then I can say that this feature is some number of sigma away from what I expect from just a purely Gaussian sky. So this is I take the template that I showed you before, which had these three free parameters, and added it in the way that I showed you as a modulation of the temperature map.
But why isn't cold ring? Why is it cold ring?
Because there's a discontinuity on the edge. So let me just show you a plot again of what the expected template is. Yeah, so it's hot in the middle and cold on the edge.
And is there some reason the mean has to be zero?
No, so we can get anything we want by considering variations of these parameters, right?
So you can make xenon bigger?
Yeah, you can make xenon bigger, negative, whatever you want.
What's the reason you picked to kind of compensate that function like that?
So what we did is basically Taylor expanded the planar perturbation about the discontinuity, the causal boundary, And the first thing you're going to get is constant. Second thing you're going to get is a modulation that looks like cosine theta when I project that planar perturbation onto the sky.
And then you're happy with this jump, discontinuity.
So in general, it could be there. It might not be there in a particular realization. So you have a Sachs-Wolfe contribution, okay? But then you also have an ISW and a Doppler effect. So depending on how the bubble collision travels inside of our bubble, then the contribution from the ISW and Doppler effect can give you a discontinuity in the edge. That's physically where it's coming from. So even if I had a constant potential, Newtonian potential was constant, but its derivative was discontinuous, then I can get a causal boundary from the ISW or Doppler effect.
But it has the whole history of the universe just spread out. So it's kind of surprising that this contribution survives.
Yeah, so now we're in the fuzz. So because we haven't done simulations of gravity of these bubble collisions, because the treatment hasn't been entirely careful yet, I want to include every possible outcome from that, okay, in doing this data analysis. But that's not a requirement, because I can just set the discontinuity to zero, and I can ask what I get.
So basically, you're looking for spots on the sky, and you're unprejudiced as to whether they're hot or cold, or
that's right.
What the shape is.
Well, I'm slightly prejudiced to the shape, because I do expect that this Taylor expansion is a good approximation to what the collision looks like. Yeah.
That's all the Taylor series is saying.
Well, it's saying that the first most important term in the variation of the temperature should go like cosine theta.
He's only keeping the first few terms.
He's only keeping the first
few terms.
Yeah.
Well, why is it cosine theta? I thought you're just expanding away from to north.
Yeah. So if I center it around the North Pole, then it goes like cosine theta. If I move it around, of course, it doesn't go like cosine theta, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So you're assuming there is a central.
So let's say that this is the Newtonian potential mm-hmm. on the surface of last scattering. I'm basically saying this, okay? So the first term in the expansion of the Newtonian potential, phi. Mm-hmm. So phi is going to go like constant plus constant times x minus x naught, where the discontinuity is located, say, at x naught. Okay, when I project that onto my past light cone, then I get something that looks like c naught tilde, some constant, plus some other constant times cosine theta plus. So if you don't like this template, that's fine. You can give me a different form of the template, and I can perform the same exact analysis. But this is my best guess.
But why is it hot in the middle and cold at the edge always?
It's not. It could be
cold
either way.
Cold in the middle, hot at the edge. It could be the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that surface could have gone down. I could have had a lower value
allowed.
Of the Newtonian.
Right, so that's
potential.
Allowed in your stuff.
Yeah. Those coefficients are completely arbitrary. Okay. So we're in the not-so-perfect world. We're talking about these needlet functions. And I can locate the places on the sky that look like they're the largest statistical deviation away from the assumption of Gaussian isotropic background fluctuations. Okay. Now, I can do a little bit better. So if I looked at some other templates, okay? So this is the same thing, it's just cosine theta plus a constant. In this case, there's no discontinuity in the edge, okay? And I look at the spherical harmonic coefficients, just doing the harmonic space transform of these functions, you get something that looks like this. So for the larger collision, you get a peak at lower L. For the smaller collision, you get a peak at bigger L. And I look at how the needlets are going to be sensitive to these collisions of different sizes. These needlets basically are a filter function in harmonic space. That's another way of thinking of them. So here is a plot of the filter functions at different needlet frequencies. And the overlap between the ALM decomposition of the template and the filter function is going to depend on the frequency of the needlet. So the needlets are sensitive to collisions of a given scale at a given J. So there's a direct correlation between the size of the thing on the sky and the frequency of the needlet that you make a detection. Okay, so there's something you can learn about this, about the size of a signal from the frequency you detect it at. So here's a CMB sky, and I've stuck a bubble collision that's hard to see with the naked eye, easier on my computer screen because it's better resolution. And here are the needlet coefficients for low frequency. Increase the frequency. Increase a little bit more. So here you'll note at this frequency there's a very large hit at the location of that collision. Basically, I've filtered the CMB sky to highlight features of that scale. And if I go higher, it disappears. Okay. So there's a direct correlation between the scale of the collision and the frequency of the needlet. And I can use this. So if I just sample many templates, if I use that form and stick in a bazillion different sets of coefficients, well, not a bazillion, more like 1,000, you can make histograms of the peak response. So this is for J equals 4. You get the peak response for J equals 4 when I have collisions somewhere between 2 and 8 degrees, say. Okay. So I sort of know if there's a bubble collision that's being detected by the needlet, what its angular scale is. It's going to be in this range. So you can build up a set of tables for different shapes of these needlets, which tell you the range of possible bubble sizes for a given needlet frequency. Now, the next thing we do is define some kind of significance threshold. So I have this map, and I've plotted the significance at different places. But I don't want to look at everything, because, again, I don't have infinite computational ability. So we have to set some kind of threshold. And the way we do that is by looking at a bubble-free end-to-end simulation of the WMAP experiment. So this is something that includes foregrounds, realistic noise. Basically, it's using the exact same algorithm that the WMAP experiment takes to get data from the satellite into a temperature map, just simulated. Okay, so this should include basically a lot of the systematics of the experiment and what we'd expect from a purely Gaussian CMB sky. So we can use the needlet information, basically, and the threshold that we set to cut the sky into blobs. So any part of the sky that passes our threshold, we're going to isolate it and define a blob around it, which has the scale we'd expect of possible bubble collisions that might be inside it. So by doing this, we've taken our full sky map and we've cut it into more manageable pieces. So now we can analyze each of these blobs separately further to look for an edge or to detect if we actually have a good fit for our template. So we can quantify how well this works. So let's simulate bubble collisions and see how well we can find them. This is a map of the noise properties of the WMAP experiment. There are regions with lower noise and regions with higher noise. And the variance you can see changes, well, the noise changes by something like 100 microkelvin. So if we put a bubble collision in a low noise region and a high noise region, and consider two sizes, 5 and 10 degrees, we can just ask for a bunch of realizations of the CMB sky, how well can we detect things. So here is a plot of parameter space in the discontinuity z-crit. And the amplitude, central amplitude of the template. And the gray regions are the case where I find the bubble from the data, and it's contained in the blob. So we'd have a good chance in the later steps of the pipeline actually doing something with it. The gray region, the detection is dependent basically on where it is on the sky, if it's in a lower noise or a high noise region, but also the background CMB realization. So you might get really unlucky and have like a huge whomping hotspot on top of where the bubble is in a given realization, and then you just can't find it. In the black region, detection is guaranteed. So for all the realizations we tried, you always locate the bubble, and it's well contained inside the blob, so you have a good chance of doing something with it.
And white means no hope.
White means no hope, yeah. White means we didn't find anything, yeah. So that's sort of our sensitivity. And so now let's talk about the next steps, which is going from this set of blobs to actual results. So here we go in parallel talking about edge detection and model selection. So we'll do edge detection first. Oh, that's terrible. So again, one of the expected theoretical signatures is this causal boundary. And that might form a detectable edge in the temperature or its derivative. So you can use edge detection schemes that are similar to those used in cosmic strings. So these authors actually pioneered the use of the canny algorithm to go from a temperature map, process it. So basically, you take the gradient map, you thin it into single edge pixels, which you cannot see. And then you keep edges that conserve their gradient over a certain length. Okay, so basically, this is trying to take a map and separate out the true edges. So here, if you could see it, there's a circle. I had a temperature discontinuity that I put in here, and it's kept. And we can quantify how well we did by doing something called the circular Huff transform. So this is actually pretty neat. So if you look at X-ray data of cancer patients, and you X-ray their lungs. Actually, they use this exact algorithm to figure out if they have tumors. So you look for edges in the X-ray data, and lung tumors are very spherical, apparently.
Somebody are caused by bubble collisions.
Surgeon General prevents me from answering that question. Okay, so what is this? Basically, you take each pixel that I've identified as a possible edge, and I draw two arcs around it that are aligned with the gradient direction of a given size. And I vary the size. And if I get the size right and there's a circular edge, you can see I get a bunch of intersections at the center of the true circular edge. And so I can just count the number of intersections for various sizes. And if you could see it, you get a huge whomping peak at the right scale if there actually is a circular edge in there. And we can quantify that by the CHT score, which is just basically the number of intersections divided by the size of the search radius that I'm looking at. You have to divide out by that because you get much more noise at larger angles just because there's more pixels. Okay. So here's our fiducial bubble collision that we simulated. It was 10 degrees. And if I look at the map of the CHT score in pixel space at that scale, I get a very large hit at 10 degrees in the true center of the bubble. Now you can look at another piece of information, which is the global maximum of this score. So I have this pixel space map, and I get a new pixel space map for each search scale that I consider. So I can plot the global maximum of the score as a function of the search radius. And you can see I get a very large peak, in this case at 10 degrees, the true radius of the edge. Okay, so this works pretty well at finding circular edges. And again, if I look at this end-to-end simulation of the experiment without any collisions embedded inside of it, so this is what I expect from systematics and just a Gaussian map, then the edgiest thing you get looks something like this, which is nothing like the bubble collision example. So again, we can quantify how well we can do by performing simulations of bubble collisions. And again, you get these sort of exclusion plots where the gray and black regions have the same meaning, and the gray region sort of depended on where the bubble was in the sky and the CMB realization. In the black region, you're effectively guaranteed a detection. So if we go into the data and we don't find anything, then the black region really represents an exclusion plot in parameter space. There's just no circular edges with the discontinuity of that value. So this is for a 5-degree bubble. That's for a 10-degree bubble. You'll notice they're different, and basically that's because the most characteristic blob size in the CMB is, of course, 1 degree. So there's a lot of 1-degree blobs on top of a 5-degree edge, then that's really going to obscure the signal. Okay, so finally we come to the model selection part of the talk, and I'm running out of time, so I'll go quick. So just to remind you, we wanted to compute this evidence ratio. The evidence is given by this. Here is the likelihood. And our model has 5 parameters. So there's the location of the bubble, the discontinuity size, the central amplitude, and the size of the disk on the sky. The covariance matrix is basically just containing the noise and cosmic variance of a Gaussian realization of the background fluctuations. And because the covariance matrix is so big, we're computationally limited to use data from regions about 22 degrees in diameter. For the priors, so that's this factor here, the prior on the parameters in the model, we basically use a flat prior. That might change if we did more careful simulations and we determined that particular values were preferred, et cetera. And the priors on the location of the bubble and its size are set by the needlet step. So we've located the most interesting parts of the sky, so we don't have to include all locations. Furthermore, from the frequency we located it at, we know the sort of range of scales the bubble might have if there was a bubble there. So that sets our priors there. And the priors on the amplitude and discontinuity are basically set by the fact that we don't see anything when we open the box. So there's an upper bound, but we go arbitrarily low. So if we look at our fiducial model and basically calculate the marginalized constraints on the parameters, so this is, you can think of the best fit value from the likelihood. So we put in a bubble with discontinuity 5 times 10 to minus 5, or amplitude 5 times 10 to minus 5. We get something well within the 1 sigma range from the marginalized parameter distribution. Same for the edge, same for the size, and the location broke our error calculating algorithm. So it's like really, really very good. So we do an amazing job of reconstructing the underlying bubble using this likelihood model selection type analysis. And if we calculate the evidence ratio, the log of the evidence ratio is about 130. So that means that the bubble collision hypothesis is favored e to the 130 times more than the just background Gaussian fluctuation hypothesis. So this is a very, very strong detection in this case. And if you run the pipeline on a bunch of different simulated bubble collisions, sort of the lesson that you learn is that the presence of an edge really helps. So if I take the same template and I change the I change the discontinuity to zero, then the log of the evidence ratio drops from 130 to 30. So the presence of an edge really gives you a very, very large lever arm on determining if this is actually a bubble collision or not. Okay, and you can do the whole pipeline on the end-to-end simulation. You get evidence ratios that look like this. So basically, the largest we found is sort of 3, evidence ratio of about 3. And we learned from this basically that for a very clear detection, you shouldn't expect foregrounds or systematics to mimic the effects of a bubble collision. So that's pretty clearly distinguishable. Okay, so quickly, the fun. So we analyzed the WMAP 7-year data and chose to primarily use the W-band map, which is the one with the highest resolution. There's a number of frequencies that WMAP measures the CMB at. And we used the conservative KQ75 mask, which cuts about 30% of the sky to remove foregrounds. 15 features passed the Needlet significance threshold we set from the simulation. 4 of them are discarded because they're very close to the mask, and therefore we consider them to be responses just to the mask. We found no evidence for circular edges, so we can go back to that exclusion plot and rule out the presence of templates which had a discontinuity somewhere between 3 and 6 times 10 to the minus 5 for bubble sizes roughly bigger than 5 to 10 degrees. And of the 11 remaining features that weren't mask responses, we found 4 had evidence ratios that were larger than expected from systematics, from the N10 experiments, and of course one of them is the famous cold spot. Checking the frequency response, so there's other frequencies we measure the data at. Basically, there's no evidence that these are foregrounds. If it was an astrophysical foreground, then we'd expect there to be some frequency variation in the response. There was none. Okay, so where were they and what are they? So here's the full sky. Each of the 4 features are all in the southern hemisphere, interestingly. If I zoom in on them, here they are. Here's the temperature data. This is a box roughly 17 degrees in size. Here is the Needlet significance plot, which again clearly highlights the location of these potential candidates. Here's the marginalized best fit template. And here's the data minus the template, basically just as a visual clue to see, you know, okay, it looks like there's just Gaussian fluctuations underneath, but that doesn't really mean anything. The real numbers to pay attention to are these evidence ratios. Okay, so feature 2, 3, 7, and 10 had evidence ratios ranging from about 4 to 7. Okay. So the largest evidence ratio we found in the end-to-end simulation of the experiment was around 3, you recall. So these are quite a bit larger. And if you simulate bubble collisions that have similar best fit parameters, you get similar evidence ratios. Now, bottom line is that all of this is in the gray area. So in these exclusion plots I showed you before, the detection, these parameters correspond to the cases where the detection was effectively just limited by the noise and the background realization of the CMB. Okay, so this is not a strong detection. This is, as we say in the paper, consistent with being bubble collisions. But the good news is that we can do far better with Planck. Okay. So there's a number of things that we want to do to check up on this. So the first thing to ask is basically how well you can distinguish hypotheses in feature finding. So another hypothesis that you might have, so for the cold spot, for example, it's been suggested that it could be evidence for a texture. And you obtain evidence ratios that are similar for bubble collisions and textures, in fact, if you compare the two. So how well can we really do with the resolution of WMAP and the noise, et cetera? In feature finding, that's a question we want to ask. With more realistic simulations of the bubble collision space-time, with more work in that direction, we can update our templates. So are we using the right thing? That's something we certainly want to test. But excitingly, with Planck, we get 3 times better resolution and 10 times lower noise. And since what we're doing is not a cosmic variance limited thing, then we really can do much better. Okay, so the both of these things, you'll recall, because I had those gray areas in my exclusion plot, will be improved. Those depended on the resolution and the noise, so we can really do a lot better. In addition, there's going to be polarization data, and this provides a complementary signature of bubble collisions. It was calculated by these guys. And you can also do cross-correlation with large-scale structure, because I have bifurcated the universe into these two different regions, and the structure is going to be moving with respect to a different co-moving frame, perhaps, in another region. So you can look for large-scale flows, et cetera. So this is future work to do. And I guess I'll conclude, because I am out of time. So in conclusion, we've developed an automated feature-finding algorithm that I think gets around a lot of the problems with making a posteriori choices in what features of the CMB are interesting things to analyze. This is quite general. It doesn't necessarily mean entirely applicable to bubble collisions, but you can use this for basically any hypothesis for a localized temperature feature in the CMB. Using simulations, we're able to define these exclusion regions in parameter space, which hopefully, again, will improve drastically with Planck data. Looking at the WMAP 7-year data, we found these four features that merit further analysis. And we're looking forward to analyzing the data from Planck and determining if these are, in fact, signatures of other bubble universes or not. Oh, we'll see. Thanks. Yeah.
Could you point to the green one, the blue one? Where are the other two?
Oh, sorry. So let's go back to the bigger picture. So they're here. They get smeared out around the south pole from the projection effects.
Oh, I see. Down there, I couldn't see.
Yeah.
So can I ask why? I mean, you're looking for relatively small bubbles.
Ah, so actually,
why not? Why can't there be a big thing that crosses over that region or something?
No, there could be, and that's implicit in here. We've made no discrimination between the bubble sizes that we're looking for, because we choose to analyze the needlet frequencies, you know, basically for any frequency. So if we would have seen a big hit at low needlet frequency, then we would have picked it up.
And so
we
might have picked up a really big thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even one that crosses that cutout thing.
Yeah, so it depends, right? I mean, if it was this size and it was in the cut, we'd have no
problem. No, but I mean, it's a really big thing.
If it was a really big thing, you'd see it for sure. It would be
huge.
I mean, actually, that would probably be ruled out just from the quadrupole constraint from the power spectrum or something like that.
How confident can I be that there are no bubbles at all of that size that hit, based on what you've done?
So for that, we'd have to go back and I'd have to show you a plot. So I had these exclusion plots. We'd have to make one for a really big bubble. So I showed you 5 and 10 degrees.
Yeah.
Sorry, where'd it go? Yeah, so I showed you 5 and 10 degrees. If you make a plot of the 25 degree set of simulations, which we did, it basically looks identical to the one for 10 degrees. So my expectation is that for bubbles larger than 10 degrees, you basically get an identical exclusion plot. Yeah, it's not going to be a whole lot different. Other questions? Yeah?
So is this work somehow related to this thing of Penrose? Or they also look for some?
No, strongly no. Yeah, strongly no. So the
can you at least comment?
Absolutely. So the prediction of this conformal cyclic cosmology of Penrose is to look for circles on the sky where the temperature variance along the circles is abnormally low. Okay, so basically you draw circles on the sky of given size, different sizes, and centered around different locations. And you ask what, if I just calculate the variance of the temperature along the circle is, do I get something that is abnormally low? I have no idea why that theory predicts that, but that's the prediction. So here, we're actually looking at the temperature space data. So it's not anything like the variance of the temperature or anything like that. It's a very, very different signal. Yeah, I guess you could look for rings of needlet coefficients that were abnormally small.
Yeah.
something like that. Sure. But I'll reiterate that I mean, it's not clear that the abnormally small variance circles are really abnormally small variants that were found. Anyway, yeah.
I've heard the claim that this is related to glitches in the W map.
Yeah, and I've also heard claims that it's related to the fact that the noise varies with position. We should get someone here to talk about that, actually. That would be nice.
Well, actually, Roger Henderson.
Okay.
So you, from the fractal structure of the bubbles, you would probably expect some kind of size distribution of the circles that you see in this.
Yeah, way. Absolutely.
And you can also look at the noise curve of the data and how detectable they are. Probably smaller circles are much more difficult to detect. And then
that's
you
right.
could get kind of an expected distribution of detected circle sizes. Does this make sense? I mean, for four circles, probably not yet, but...
Yeah, so from the theory side, you actually know what to expect, again, in the same sort of set of approximations. I don't know. Oh, whoops. That was wrong. Anyone know how to make the lights go? Yeah. Cheers. So if you calculate the number of collisions you'd expect to see of a given angular size, it basically goes like sine theta. So that's from theory. But this is just the number of collisions you'd expect in your past light cone. So it's unclear what the distribution of bubble sizes that actually give strong signatures are. To figure that out, you'd need to actually do simulated collisions, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. But that's what's known on the theory side. Okay. But what you say is certainly right. So if you go below roughly a degree, you're never going to find anything because there's so many degree-sized blobs in the CMB. And there's a sort of sweet spot, I'd say, below like 60 degrees or something like that. Which we've analyzed, and you know, there you don't have such a large region of the sky that you can't do anything computationally, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so there's definitely a most detectable range, like just from the perspective of data analysis. So I have no idea, you know, how the simulated collisions would come out. I don't know what you'd expect to be the most detectable thing if you include more realistic physics.
But you found four possible bubbles,
right.
The biggest of which is?
They're roughly, 10-ish degrees. Yeah.
10-ish degrees.
Yeah, 10-ish degrees.
And again, it's related to my other question. How uh-huh. confident can we be that there's nothing bigger? Like, highly uh-huh. confident?
As confident as those exclusion plots show. I mean, yeah, so I mean.
So maybe when plot comes along, you might find big things. Is that unthinkable? Based on what
it's not unthinkable, right? It's not unthinkable, but...
How much money would you bet?
Not much.
Not much?
Yeah, not much.
So then isn't that a bit strange to get bubbles all over the southern hemisphere, four of them and not that big? That doesn't sound like what was said over here. I'd expect them to be...
Well, you'd expect an isotropic distribution, that's true.
Yeah.
Okay, so you expect an isotropic distribution, and again, in this sort of toy model calculation, you know the size distribution. So these are relatively unlikely sizes, right, because they're sort of...
And an unlikely distribution angle-wise.
Right, and an unlikely distribution angle-wise. So you can build that in. I mean, you can build that prejudice into this ratio of model priors, basically. Okay, so... Take those evidence ratios I showed you, and now you have to multiply them by a compensating factor to account for the fact that we're in this sort of maybe weird range of parameter space. But what I think is an unsettled question is sort of exactly what you'd expect the distribution of visible things to be. So this toy model calculation might or might not give you a good idea of the distribution of visible sizes. So for that, we need to do more work.
What about other stuff crashing in through our bubble, if I believe any of this at all. Like, maybe there's some giant cosmic string out there that wrecked or hit us or some other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Could this analysis be extended?
Sure. If you have anything in in the temperature data, any template that you want to analyze, this can do it. Yeah, certainly. So I should say some of the future directions we're thinking about is to actually look for other things in the CMB data using similar methods such as cosmic strings, topological defects, etc. I mean, this is it's a pretty multi-purpose tool for looking for temperature space features in the CMB data. Yeah. Uh-huh.
You mentioned that none of your four candidates survived the edge detector test. Like,
yeah.
So what exactly happened? Was there no circular edge? Did they fail the counting at the center test?
Yeah,
what
so
happens when you try to do edge detection effects in those four candidates?
So I'd show you, but I screwed up the projector. Remember the so there was this plot of the global maximum of the CHT score as a function of search radius.
Mm-hmm.
And for the end-to-end simulation, you get something that looks like this, where there's no real strong peak. For the bubble case, you got something that looked like this, where there's this huge peak. So all of the WMAP features were more or less consistent with what we found in the end-to-end simulation. Okay, so that means there's no strong global maximum. We had some criteria that was set by, you know, the sort of height of the peaks you'd expect from the end-to-end simulation, and it was just consistent with that. So there's no evidence for.
So how concerned should we be about the, I mean, is this something that, given WMAP's resolution, the fact that it washed out the edge,
The primary uncertainty is theoretical. Actually don't know, this is some toy model, right? Okay, but no one has actually sat down with full gravity, done bubble collision simulation, and derived rigorously what the temperature modulation should be.
Okay.
Okay.
So it's possibly theoretically that kink isn't really there, it's quite smooth out,
yeah.
And then you wouldn't see the edge.
Yeah. Yeah. So that work needs to be done to figure out if that's there.
Conversely, suppose you found gravity made an edge even stronger, and wouldn't that be bad news for these candidate plots?
Absolutely, and that would be fantastic, because then we could do much more, right? I mean, we do have these exclusion plots that we could make and say, okay, and within a certain range of parameters, there's nothing there. Yeah, so that would be fantastic, either way, if it's there or if it's not there. Yeah.
When can we present some plot data?
So the release date is going to be 2013. Public release of the data. Everything we have should be ready to go. So, day of the release plus one.
Have two versions of the paper.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm serious. You can put them apart with it.
Yeah, I know. I know.
They've got their paper ready. Plug the numbers.
Leave the numbers blank. Yeah.
The positive paper.
Yeah, totally. But like all the simulations and everything, we're going to do that far in advance, of course. So, yeah, we'll know what we can find. Thanks. Yeah.